test this? Oh, we got good sound. Good. And yeah, that's Annie. She's one of our missionaries. She gave a great report in the first service in North Africa there, working with nomadic villagers. And she told an amazing story of how this chief, who is very opposed to Christianity, is now actually asking to hear messages from the Bible. So yeah, thank you for requesting that prayer, Steve. And hopefully that will work out. Yes, I'm going to be doing a lot of travel in the month of November. In fact, last week I was in North Carolina participating in the largest apologetics conference that's held in North America. It's the National Conference of Christian Apologetics. It's held every year about this time in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they broke an attendance record this year. So there was about 2,500 people in attendance at that particular conference. And as always, they have me give brand new talks, and I was able to give brand new talks because I test them out on you people right here. So one talk I gave was on, I called it the ultimate darts player. Haven't really given all the details here in the class, but told the story about how this one dart player in Britain is just so far ahead of every other dart player in the world. No one comes close to his accomplishments. But then I talked about the ultimate darts player, the one that's throwing darts at planet Earth. And I just talked about three of the darts, because in a dart game, you throw three darts at a time. So let's just look at the last three darts that the ultimate darts player is throwing at planet Earth. And these are three of the biggest asteroids that have ever hit the Earth. One hit 2.5 million years ago. One hit 800,000 years ago. One hit just 12,800 years ago. And when these were first being discussed in the scientific literature, most scientists said this can't possibly be. There's no way our planet gets that many giant asteroid collisions in that short of a period of time. And where's the evidence? Where are the craters? And this will be coming out in my next book. By the way, we got a title for the book now. It's called Weathering Climate Change. It'll be coming out in early 2020. But the reason for the skepticism, they says, where are the craters? If you got an asteroid a mile in diameter hitting the Earth and it's made of stainless steel, it's going to make a really big hole, and there's no way you're not going to see it. Well, it turns out there were three very good reasons why we don't see it. And it's a good thing. If we were going to see it, we wouldn't be here. But the first of these darts hit in a part of off the south tip of South America, and it splashed into 17,000-foot depth ocean. And so that's why we don't see a crater. It's 17,000 feet below the surface. And with that much water, even at the bottom of the ocean floor, there's no crater. But they found all the isotope signatures telling them that a really massive asteroid hit there. And as the people who wrote the research paper said, it caused a big splash. So, and the splash was tidal waves 1,000 feet high, radiating all over the Earth. Where one of them actually came up through the Adriatic Ocean, which was tells you the magnitude of this hit, that the tidal wave actually impacted the upper parts of the Adriatic Sea. They actually found this huge wall of mud that had been piled up there in the Adriatic Sea. So even the Mediterranean Sea was impacted by this event. And then how the second one hit 800,000 years ago. And you probably heard of the Spratly Islands. That's in the South China Sea. These little tiny islands that six different nations are fighting over to see who controls them, because they're right in the middle of the South China Sea. Well, a group of scientists said there actually was a fairly single big island there. What happened is a giant asteroid hit 800,000 years ago and basically obliterated this huge island, and all that's left are these little tiny specks. But that first dart actually initiated the Ice Age cycle. If it wasn't for that first dart causing an aerosol cloud over the Earth, blocking out the light of the sun, we wouldn't have had an Ice Age cycle today. And I explained at the conference why an ice age cycle is essential for us to have billions of humans on the face of the Earth. The ice age cycle, I've said this before in the class, melting ice left over from the last ice age irrigates the great agricultural plains. But with each ice episode, you get two major fertilization events. And so we not only have water for the great agricultural plains, we have the fertilizer that makes them fertile enough so we can feed billions of human beings. But what that second asteroid did, it changed the ice age cycle from a 41,000-year periodicity to about 100,000 years. And with 100,000 years, you get 10 to 12,000 years of a warm interglacial. With 41,000 years, you get about 3,000 years. Not enough time to launch civilization. 10 to 12,000 years, you got enough time to launch civilization. But it was that particular asteroid that put up a debris cloud that our Earth passes through every 100,000 years as it orbits around the Sun. And then the third asteroid hit just 12,800 years ago. And that's the one that caused the greatest skepticism. As I said, there's no way you're going to get an asteroid a mile in diameter just 12,800 years ago, and we don't have plenty of evidence for it. Well, it turns out it was 3,000 feet below the ice in northwest Greenland. And, you know, being that buried under that much ice, people didn't see it until a NASA aircraft by chance flew over the Greenland, that part of the Hiawatha ice field in Greenland, with deep ice-penetrating radar, and they said, we see a circular. They actually saw the crater, and the crater is 32 kilometers in diameter under 3,000 feet of ice, which caused them to send a scientific team to the site, and the meltwater coming off under that 3,000 feet of ice had the signature of a stainless steel asteroid. But it was that particular event that stopped the what typically happens, and I should show you this, but I don't have it right here, is that what typically happens when you come up out of an ice age is a temperature rises to a peak, hits a peak, and rapidly drops down into an ice age. That has happened in every single ice age cycle except the one we're in right now. What happened in one right now is a temperature began to go up starting about 11,000 years ago. It began to go up, and then this asteroid hit, and instead of the temperature jumping up to its normal peak of about 2 to 3 degrees centigrade warmer than it is right now, that asteroid basically cooled down the entire planet. In fact, it cooled it by 15 degrees Fahrenheit and kept it cold for 1,200 years. And because of that asteroid hitting and causing all that ice to go up in the atmosphere, actually caused giant stones to hit North America, diverted the flows of the major rivers in North America, which actually cooled the North Atlantic, that cooling event stopped the temperature from going up to its maximum. It stopped short by 3 degrees centigrade, and that's what has actually been responsible for the last 9,500 years of extreme climate stability. So that was my talk, my first talk. You need three perfectly thrown darts. Darts where you've got asteroids of exactly the right mass, exactly the right composition, hitting at exactly the right time, and exactly the right place, or we wouldn't be here with billions of human beings and our civilization today. So, talk was very well received, very well attended, and yeah, it's like, hey, my whole point was every year of research that goes by, we get a stronger case for the supernatural handiwork of God in our nature for our benefit. My second talk was on habitable zones. And that was by request because people are saying, we hear all this talk from NASA that there's 41 billion habitable planets in our galaxy alone. And so my response to that was, well, they're only looking at one habitable zone. the liquid water habitable zone, which is the widest of all the known planetary habitable zones. It's basically the distance from the host star where the temperature on the surface of the planet would be between 0 and 100 degrees centigrade, which makes it possible to have liquid water. But I also pointed out they get that 41 billion habitable planet figure by kind of lowering the requirement down to what do we need to get liquid water on a square kilometer of the surface of the planet for 3 months or more. Well, if all you got is liquid water on a planet over only 1 square kilometer for just 90 days, that's really not a prescription for life. The water's got to hang around a lot longer than that, and it's got to cover a large surface of the planet. But if you only require water to be there on a tiny part of the planet's surface for a very short period of time, it significantly widens the habitable zone because you can always alter the atmosphere in order to get the temperature colder or warmer. But mainly I talked about the 12 other known habitable zones and described each of them. There's articles on our website at reasons.org. If you just do the search for habitable zones, you'll see 3 articles I've written that describes these different habitable zones. But what was interesting, each of those other 12 are much narrower than the liquid water habitable zone. And for a planet to be truly habitable, it must simultaneously reside in all 13 planetary habitable zones. And I briefly talked about the fact there's galactic habitable zones and intergalactic habitable zones. But just looking at those planetary habitable zones, so far we astronomers have found only one planet that resides in even 3 of those 13 habitable zones. That one planet also happens to reside in all 13. But we don't find any planets, any known planets. We now know of more than 4,100. None of them reside in 3, let alone 13. And so I just ended my talk by saying I'm going to leave it to all of you to guess which planet actually simultaneously resides in all 13 habitable zones. So, and that's kind of what I do at that conference every year. I give them brand new talks, and I'm actually, thanks to this class, I'm scheduled to give a new talk at next year's conference, which is going to be, if you were here the last couple of weeks, where I take you through the extragalactic habitable zones, where we look at our cluster of galaxies and the cluster that it resides in, the supercluster, the supercluster resides in, and actually take you out to the very edge of the universe itself, and you get to see, as you move away from our galaxy, out into the extreme edges of the universe, in every case, we are in that unique habitable zone. There's really nowhere else in the universe that you can put a galaxy or a planet in which advanced life would be possible. Everywhere else, that's hostile to life, basically making the point the entire universe is designed to make possible our existence. So that'll be the talk I'll be giving next year. Now, I got to speak on the first day, and what happened after I spoke is there were a number of scientists that are of a young Earth creationist perspective who spoke after me. And basically, they gave 2 talks saying that everything I said in my first talk was wrong. That was kind of their message. And they were basically saying, you know, that all this talk about us having this, you know, extremely stable climate, it's got nothing to do with these greenhouse gases. And by the way, when Dr. Ross spoke about these ice cores, he's misinterpreting them. I didn't show this slide, but basically it was making the point that we can actually see the ice age cycle in the ice cores in Greenland, in the Alps, and in Antarctica. And I did show a slide basically showing people the last 8 ice ages and how you can use these ice cores and it'll tell you the global mean temperature over the past 800,000 years and you can easily see this 100,000 year cycle like this. Very crudely, it looks like this. That's a diagram showing you the last 8 Ice Age cycles. And their comment was, being young Earth creationists, they weren't too happy about these ice core results I was citing, because it establishes that the Earth at a minimum must be 800,000 years old. And actually there is one ice core, I didn't talk about it, where they've been able to drill through 1.5 million annual layers. So I would show that it's at least 1.5 million years old. And they said, oh yes, I didn't mention this in my talk, but it's in my books. They said, Dr. Ross claims that these are actual annual layers because you can see the dust signatures of known volcanoes that erupted in recorded history. And this one does show that, where you can actually see in one particular dust layer the dust signature of the Krakatoa eruption. I think that was in 1887. And so you can count down the layers, and if they're annual layers right at 1887, you see the dust signature of Krakatoa. And during the Roman Empire era, Vesuvius had a major eruption that wiped out Pompeii. Well, the dust signature of that Pompeii-destroying volcanic eruption also shows up in all these ice cores. And not just in one ice core, but in all the ice cores. And that's just two examples. All the volcanic eruptions that have happened in the last 3,000 years, where we've got historical dates for them, you can see the individual dust signatures in those layers, basically establishing they really are annual layers. Moreover, just looking at the Newtonian's laws of physics, basically just assuming that the law of gravity operates, you can see this 100,000-year cycle and being driven by the 100,000-year variation in the shape of Earth's orbit, the eccentricity of Earth's orbit. And so that basically establishes that indeed these are annual layers. Well, the two speakers there were basically saying, Dr. Ross is mistaken. We're not able to determine the difference between dust storms coming off of deserts and dust coming from volcanic eruptions, or dust coming from these asteroid collisions, because you actually see the dust signature of these asteroid collisions in these ice cores as well. So, and then a whole bunch of people came to me after the talk and said, this is really true that we can't tell the difference between these periodic dust storms that come off the Sahara Desert and what we see in these volcanic eruptions. And I had to tell them, no, it's very easy to tell the difference. You get a very different isotope signature from dust storms that come off of deserts, when wind storms blow, and what you get from a volcanic eruption. And again, a very distinct signal when you get a major asteroid hit on the Earth. And it says, moreover, it's not just one ice core. We see it in all 5 of the Greenland ice cores, and all four of the Greenland ice cores, all 5 of the Antarctic ice cores, and also in the ice core in the Alps. And then one of them was saying, well, you know, you're just assuming these are annual layers. In fact, if we go to South Greenland, you see that you get several layers per winter. And my response to that is, well, yeah, it's warm in South Greenland, and the ice is thin in South Greenland. Notice all these ice cores are in the high altitude parts of North and Central Greenland, where indeed you only get one layer per year. And likewise in Antarctica, they don't do the core drills around the coast, they do them in the interior. These really are annual layers. And again, I think the proof of that is you can actually count the number of layers down, and they're exactly the number of layers or number of years that we see in recorded history for these different volcanic eruptions. And then they said, well, why are they distorting the real situation? I says, well, they're young Earth creationists. They don't like these ice cores because they establish that the Earth is a whole lot older than 10,000 years. But I can tell you this, I've talked to these young Earth scientists privately when there's no audience around. And what's interesting, they admit that this is one of the biggest challenges to their young Earth interpretation, because it really is so concrete. You've got these core drills, moreover, they're calibrated by carbon-14. are calibrated by tree rings. Incidentally, not too far from here, there is a tree in Rubidoux, a suburb of Riverside, where the world's oldest tree exists. So you can go to Rubidoux and see this tree. It has 13,600 rings in it. Now, it's a cluster of trees, and so you do get an overlap. It's not in a single tree, because this is a clone-type tree, and that's where you actually get the longest continuous record of tree rings. And there's several clone trees. There's one in Germany, and there's a couple here in North America, but they do indeed establish 13,000 annual rings. And incidentally, you can see the dust signature of volcanoes in tree rings as well as in the ice cores. But I had no idea that, you know, I thought I probably should have said, why don't you put my talk later rather than putting it right at the beginning. But it was sad for me just to see how much confusion was being caused there. It's like, who do we trust? And I says, well, you know, you can always look at the original papers. That's one of the great things about the scientific literature these days. Yes, they charge you money to read the entire paper, but every research journal, they require that the abstracts be made available free of charge to everybody. And for many journals, once 2 years have gone by, the entire paper is free. So I was sharing at the conference how you can actually check out the claims of the different speakers that are being made at the conference simply by going online. That's the beauty of the internet. You can check things out. But it says, don't just look at the popular articles you see there. They say, well, how do we know which lay articles we can trust? If they cite the original peer-reviewed research, I think you can trust what they're saying. If they don't cite it, I would read it with a big grain of salt. The really credible articles that are out there on science are ones where they actually give you a link to the original papers so you can check it out for yourself. And here's a tip too. Yes, you can get the abstract for free. If you want to read the whole paper without paying $35 to $40, get the preprint. There's a site called ARXIV where they have a huge library of the preprints of all the published scientific research papers. And once you can go there, you can determine, did it get published? If it didn't get published, then I would again treat it with a big grain of salt. But if that preprint eventually got published as a research paper where you got to pay money, well, number one, see if the abstract is the same. If the abstract on the paper in the journal is the same as the one in the preprint, that means you can very probably trust everything in the paper, and the entire paper on that preprint site you can read for free. So that's how you get around the paywall. Little tip, and incidentally, I do that myself all the time. I don't want to pay $40 for all these papers. So often that's how I work with this. And again, I take advantage of the fact that after a couple of years go by, it's free. Also, another thing I've noticed with the major research journals, if it's a paper of special significance to a much broader audience, the journal will often make the entire paper free. Moreover, they tell the scientists that are writing the paper, if you pay us a little more money, then we'll make the paper free for everybody. So if you're willing to come up with, say, $20,000, then the journal will make it free right away to everybody. But sometimes the research is of such significance that the journal just decides to eat the costs and they make it available for free. So don't be shy of having to be scared of that paywall you see on these science journal websites. There's many creative ways at getting around those sites. Well, before we jump into our study of Isaiah, I wanted to make you aware of a paper that got published just a couple of days ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, USA. And this is a journal that's sponsored by the members of the National Academy of Sciences, and the membership is very selective. I think there's only like 1,700 scientists that are members of the National Academy of Sciences. And they refer to themselves as the better scientists, the top scientists. However, I know a lot of really top-rate scientists that are not members of the National Academy of Sciences. The only way you get to be a member is if you're appointed by the existing members. So the existing members select who they're going to bring on. But they have a journal, and it's a very good journal, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But the only way you can get published in that journal is if you're sponsored by one of the members. Now, the member may not actually have written the paper, but they'll be the one that reviews the paper. And so this paper I got in front of me is not, these are not members. These two people are not members, but a member actually sponsored it. Now, I wrote about the National Academy of Sciences in my book More Than a Theory because there was a survey done of research scientists across North America and how 45% of them believe in God and an afterlife. The same percentage when the survey was done in 1916, basically showing there's always been a reasonably high percentage of research scientists in North America that believe in God and an afterlife. The National Academy of Sciences was quite incensed by that publication, and they said, well, we just surveyed our 1,700 members, and only 7% believe in God and an afterlife. But as you actually look into the National Academy of Sciences, there's a committee that chooses future members. And guess what? They're all atheists. So who are they going to select to be members? Now, I'm not saying that there's bias all the way through, because I do know of some people who are theists that are members of the National Academy of Sciences, but I also know some scientists who are really outstanding. In fact, I know one who was declared the best scientist of best scientist in the world for 2013, and you think, well, that should be adequate to get him membership in the National Academy of Sciences, but he's a very bold Christian. And he basically told me, they're never going to allow me into the National Academy of Sciences. But 7%. But that's what impressed me about this paper, because this paper is all about prayer. I said, I've never seen anything like this published in the National Academy of Sciences journal. And here it is. And quite interesting what they said. It talks about the value of prayers. And what they did is they worked with a sample of a people in North Carolina. And this is right after they had that Florence hurricane that caused widespread damage. They went to the damaged area and they randomly selected 482 adults. And then they put them through a test. And the test consisted of, here's $5. And so they said to the 482, here's $5. You can either keep the $5 or you can use the $5 to get a Christian to pray for you as you recover from this disaster. Or you can just keep the $5. Or what you could do is use that $5 to make sure that nobody prays for you. And they actually broke it up into 13 different tests, but the most significant results were this, is that the Christians in the group, those who identified themselves as Christians, and of course not all Christians who identify themselves as Christians are really Christians, but those that identified themselves as Christians were willing to pay money to have a stranger who was a Christian pray for them. But they weren't willing to pay money if it was, an atheist or an agnostic or someone who wasn't a Christian, but they were willing to pay money to get a Christian they've never met to pray for them. And then they looked at the subset of people who identified themselves as agnostics and atheists, and what they found was they were indifferent as to whether somebody could pray for them unless they were a Christian. If they were a Christian, they did not want prayer. In fact, they were willing to pay $5 to ensure that no Christian would be praying for them. Now, the paper just ends. There is no discussion on the spiritual implications of the research. But to me, as I read the paper, those implications jump right off the page. Isn't it interesting that agnostics and atheists will pay money to guarantee that no Christian will be praying for them in the midst of their trials, recovering from this hurricane? On the other hand, Christians in the group are very willing to pay for another Christian to pray for them. And the indifference, as long as it wasn't a Christian, the atheists and agnostics didn't care. But if it was a Christian, I'm going to pay money to make sure that they're not praying for me. So, and to me, in fact, I'll just jump this out to you. For me, it was kind of obvious what was going on here philosophically and spiritually, but I want to just get your reaction to this. What do you think this study is really implying? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, wait for the microphone because, you know, this is live streamed. So if you could repeat that.
I'm surprised that the agnostics went along with not wanting Christians to pray for them.
Well, that's a very interesting comment because I would have been anticipating, well, I can see why committed atheists may not want a Christian praying for them, but why the agnostics? Agnostics, by definition, are people who really, are on the fence or don't care. However, I think it points out something, is that people who identify themselves as agnostics really are not neutral. And that's kind of what this study, when the money's on the table, they're not neutral. And so people who identify themselves as agnostic, at least in North Carolina, maybe it's different here in California, but at least in North Carolina, people who identify themselves as agnostics are really people that are using their money the same way that atheists do. And so maybe they're really not agnostics, as a dictionary defines agnostics. Okay, back here.
Well, it indicates to me that they think there's some power there. Otherwise, why would they bother spending their money?
Well, that's one thing, is like, okay, maybe there's something to this prayer. The thing that struck me is, and I don't know what you think about this, maybe it's just that atheists and agnostics don't like Christians. That's a possibility. Or they don't like the Christian God. I'm okay if that's some other God, but the Christian God, forget it. So, maybe, yes, right here.
Yeah, it's been my experience that atheists and agnostics have a reaction against Christianity. The two kind of go together. Like, you know, when I talk to other people, you know, from other countries or other religions, there's not that resistance. There's more openness. But with atheists, often they grew up or they've been exposed to Christianity, or they have family members who they butt up against or react to that have Christianity, and there's a resistance there that there isn't with other people. So I think that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, and it could be, I think that's a good comment, Steve, in that maybe in North Carolina, agnostics and atheists, kind of since it's a Bible Belt state, they've maybe been exposed to Christianity, didn't like what they see, and maybe that explains why they're willing to spend money to make sure a Christian doesn't pray for them in a time of need and a disaster. And, I think that's something a number of scholars have pointed out, at least with atheists here in North America, they've tend to have had an early bad experience with Christianity in one shape or other. In fact, there's a philosopher by the name of Paul Vitz who wrote a book about the fatherless and was really referring to the fact that people who are public atheists all have a story of a bad relationship with their earthly father. And, you know, as you look at the Christian faith, it keeps making this analogy between our Father in heaven and our earthly father. And it's like, you know, if your earthly father treated you well and loved you, it makes it easier for you to accept the fatherhood of the God. But if your earthly father was abusing you, then it's much more challenging. It's a very good book, by the way, by Paul Vitz, if you've not read it. Got another comment here? Yeah.
I think what's really interesting is, are atheists really atheists? to, because they believe that the Bible is just a bunch of fables, a bunch of stories that aren't true. What we believe it is not true. Yet to do what they did almost implies that they know that there's something there. So are they truly atheists?
That's a very good point, because here they got $5. If they really were convinced the God of the Bible doesn't exist, then I might as well keep the $5, right? It's not going to make any difference. But the fact that they're willing to use that $5 to ensure that a Christian doesn't pray for them tells me they're not treating the God of the Bible like the tooth fairy or the great pumpkin. Because if this is just, you know, a myth without any scientific or historical support, I might as well just keep the $5. So there's something there that's motivating them to actually use their money. Now, you know, I shared this with some of our scientists, and they said, well, you know, in America, $5 isn't what it used to be. Maybe they need to repeat the experiment with $500 and see what kind of results they get. But, you know, actually, to support the research there, I think they had a funding issue. $482 times five, I mean, that's a big part of your budget. So, but I thought even $5, to me, $5 is something, you know, I treasure. So it's like, I think it's sufficient money. Okay, another comment here.
You got about three more people.
So for me, it comes down to belief. That if you pay $5 for a Christian to pray for you, that means you believe that there's a God, and atheists and agnostics hold the position that there is no God.
You know, that's the one comment that these two researchers did make in their concluding paper, is that Christians value prayer from Christians that they don't know. And atheists have a disvalue, is that they really are willing to spend money to ensure that the prayer doesn't happen. They were expecting, I could tell from the way they wrote the paper, they were expecting the atheists and agnostics just to pocket the $5. It's like, you know, hey, this God doesn't exist, forget it, doesn't make any difference. And what's interesting was they were totally indifferent for someone praying for them that wasn't a Christian. They're not a Christian, we don't care if they're praying for me or not. So it basically shows you they believe that the prayers of non-Christians really have no value. But the prayers of Christians do, in their opinion, have a disvalue. And that's how they concluded their paper. Christians see value in other Christians praying for them. Atheists and agnostics see a disvalue of having Christians praying for them. But if they're not a Christian, they don't put any value on it at all. Now, it's something I saw. Well, I've got a couple more comments. Okay,
yeah,
a couple
right
more, then I'll make a comment. Go ahead.
What's the name of that article or the author?
The name of the article is called The Value of Thoughts and Prayers. And it's in the...
Oh, okay.
Okay, and the two authors...
That's, I should be able to find
Linda
it.
Linda Thunstorm and Shiri Noy. Okay. And they're both at the University of Wyoming.
Awesome. And in the study, did the people know how the prayer would be administered?
They
like,
didn't.
Like from afar, from being in person, because, you know, if especially North Carolina, and I have family down in southeastern Kentucky right across the border, went to a church I thought was fun, and then I opened my eyes and the snakes are out, you know? So there's a lot of, you know, and the different types of prayer in a lot of the super exciting churches that if they think it's put your hand on, shake around and stuff, then they might not be as much as far as if they're going to be across the room, not even near me praying. I feel like atheist or agnostic might have a different decision.
Well, what they wrote in the paper is they were concerned because Christians have a reputation for being altruistic. They said, we need to take that out of the experiment. So they told everybody that $5 is not going to pay the person that's praying. We keep the $5. So it's not going to have any impact on the people that will be praying for you or not praying for you. No, no. They said it's going to be a total stranger. Yeah. Different city, total stranger. We're not going to release the name. It's not going to be a relative or a friend. It's actually going to go to a different city to recruit these people to be praying for you. And actually, the researchers didn't do anything. They were testing the motivation of these 482 that were part of the sample size. But yeah, they did take pains to tell them there will be no material benefit to the people who will be praying or not praying. Yes.
Oh, just a quick thought. Maybe the atheists are simply making a statement. You know, if I do not want Christians to pray for me because they're so hostile against Christianity. So by putting that money out there instead of keeping it, they're definitely making a statement. I don't necessarily believe they think there's any power in Christian prayer at all. I think they're just simply making a cultural stand that they don't want any part of it, and they're glad to pay not to let you know that. That was my thought.
Well, that could be. I mean, I've seen that happen to me personally when I've been engaging in atheists and, you know, volunteer to pray for them. They say, no, I don't want you to pray for me. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. If they were really true the atheists, they wouldn't care if anybody prayed for them, because they would think it has no value. So they're refusal to want a Christian pray for him is purely a statement of antagonism.
Well, that thing that came out in the study, they don't care if it's a non-Christian. They only care if it's a Christian. So yeah, I think you're both making the point. They're making a statement about what they think about Christians.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, and maybe they're talking more than that, but that's a minimum. At least they're making a statement about what they think about Christians. Go ahead.
Okay, if I'd have a Christian pray for me for free.
Yep, good point. I don't charge for my prayers either.
Right, that's right.
So that's a good point.
Okay, here.
Okay, we got one more here.
Well, I have, first of all, I'd like to know, was this done in a public situation or a private situation where the person was asked that question?
Yeah. I mean, they picked these 482 people at random. And, it was a private conversation between the two researchers and that individual. They didn't have them all in one group.
Okay. Now, the second thing I'd like to say is, maybe they just, the idea of subsidizing Christianity, they saw that $5 as...
Well, that's why they told them, the money will not go to the person that's praying.
Uh-huh.
Says, if you, we'll use that money to ask somebody to pray, but we're not going to pay them a dime. And moreover, if you want a person to not pray, they're not going to get any money either. So basically it said, we want to take the cash out of the equation at all. They were given $5, but the whole point is they could have kept the $5. Instead, they were motivated to use that $5 in one case to get somebody to pray for them, another case to use the $5 to make sure nobody prays for them who is a Christian. That's basically the element of the story there. And when I read this paper, it reminded me of what happened to me when I was at Caltech speaking at the International Skeptic Society Conference. They have this conference every 2 years, and it's where they invite skeptics, who almost entirely are atheists, from around the world to come and hear lectures on why God doesn't exist. And so I participated in this conference. My role was to debate the particle physicist Victor Stenger at the end of the conference. But I attended all the lectures before the debate. I kind of wanted to know where they were coming from. And so I got to hear 6 different lectures before my debate. And these were all world-renowned scientists giving hour-long talks each on why they felt science proved there was no God. But what I noticed in all the lectures, similar to what I saw here, the lectures were all focused on the God of the Bible. It's like the God of Islam, the God of Hinduism, the God of Confucius. All those were ignored. The whole focus was the God of the Bible. And I says, that's interesting. All these speakers are targeting the non-existence of the God of the Bible. They don't care about these other gods. And also I noticed how passionate they were about the non-existence of the God of the Bible. There was emotion in all their talks. They weren't just presenting what they thought was the best scientific evidence against God. They were presenting it with a lot of emotion for this. With one exception. The one exception was the agnostic speaker, Paul Davies. And he was the most neutral of them all, but he was actually presenting what he said is, look, there's evidence for God. You know, I'm not convinced it identifies the God of the Bible, so he was the only exception there. And then there was a debate, and then the Q&A, all these questions came up towards me. I mean, that was what was interesting too, is that when it came time for Q&A after the debate, the questions were all directed at me. That went on for about 35, 40 minutes, and Michael Shermer, the host for the conference, said, no more questions for Hugh Ross. He invited all the previous speakers to come up on the platform and said, ask them questions. And I had to sit down. I said, moratorium, no more questions for Hugh Ross. But the questions I did get addressed, what I noticed again was their emotion. And it's like they seem to be really angry at this God of the Bible. And so after the conference was over, I stayed, because I mean, all these people were shut down from asking me questions. I could tell they wanted to carry on. So I stayed for 3 more hours to answer their questions and to engage them. But around about hour 2.5, I had this crowd around me, and I said, something I've observed about this conference, I think all of you here, all 700 of you, really do believe in the God of the Bible. They said, no, we don't. I said, well, notice your speakers. They only target the God of the Bible, and look at all their emotion. And it says, if they really didn't believe in the God of the Bible, they'd be treating the God of the Bible like the tooth fairy. But they don't. This emotion, this passion, all this research they poured in it, talking for a whole hour. Have you ever heard anybody talk for a whole hour in the scientific evidence against the tooth fairy? Or some scientists with a PhD in physics getting all emotionally and wrought up over the tooth fairy? Doesn't happen. And so I says, I think all this emotion and focus tells me you really do believe in the God of the Bible. You just don't like him. And I said, I also notice the emotion I'm hearing from you and from the speakers, it's one of being very upset and angry about the God of the Bible. You don't like him. But what was interesting is they began to share with me, it's not so much that we hate the God of the Bible as that we despise his followers. I said, okay, start telling me your stories. And it's like the advice I got from an individual many years ago. It says, when you meet someone with a different sexual perspective than you have, you know, a bisexual, a homosexual, a lesbian, and they challenge you and you say, okay, where in the Bible does it say my sexual behavior is a sin? It says, before you answer that question, listen to their story. Find out what it was that led them into the sexual behavior that they're exhibiting today. And you'll always find a story of pain. Same thing I found with these atheists that were gathered around me. Every one of them had a story of pain, a painful encounter with one or more Christians in their past. But I said, and what was interesting, at Caltech, most of these atheists were engineers and scientists. I said, you're engineers and scientists. I mean, you're paid to be rational and logical. Is it rational and logical to let a human being that the Bible declares is sinful and full of evil get between you and a God who has no sin and no evil and has a desire to have a compassionate, loving relationship with you? Does that make sense? And they said, we hear what you're saying. However, we still feel like these Christians have really wronged us. So, again, these engineers and scientists, rational and logical. However, it's just like the rest of us. If there's a deep wound there, it's going to cloud their ability to reason and think. So, but this paper here basically stopped short of making any comments. I think if they did make comments, maybe it wouldn't have got published in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But I am impressed. This is the first time I've actually seen any study like this get published. Okay. Yes. Yeah, wait for the microphone.
I'd like to make a connection between the science that you explained and also the antagonism that we see here in, towards Christianity. This past week, I read some data in the Wall Street Journal, the result of Pew Research. They showed that since 2009 till the present, believers in Christianity, or maybe it was those that went to church, went down 9%.
Right.
In a period of, I guess this is a period of 10 years, a tremendous decrease. And so what comes to me is that these are people that are just turning off Christianity. And so that my idea is that regardless of how rational and logical we are, even producing this kind of argument that you've given us here, how it supports scientifically Christianity, that is not the issue that we have to overcome is how do we talk to these people? I mean, people are running away from Christianity, and it's a matter of becomes a matter of communicating with them some of these truths, and their willingness to listen to them. That they're basically not even willing to listen.
Yeah, good point.
That's what I see.
Okay, because that's something else that surprised me when I was there at Caltech. Okay, given that they've had such bad experiences with Christians, why were they so eager to engage me? I mean, for 3 hours. And they were not angry or hostile towards me. But their comment was, when you debated Victor Stenger, you treated him with kindness. We've never seen that in a debate between a Christian and atheist before. They're expecting me to be very hostile towards Victor, and the fact that they didn't see that, I think, has opened up their willingness to engage. And when I listened to their stories, over 80% of the stories I heard from the 40 that I interviewed was, okay, a friend of mine took me to a church. I had questions. I posed those questions. I was told to shut up. Or, you know what, I had issues with trying to integrate science and what Christianity claims. And when I brought up the issues, I was told to leave. Now, you mentioned this Pew study. Barna has also done research on the fact that we're seeing a less and less population of people that regularly go to church. But what Barna did is they followed up those people that had left and said, why did you leave? The two top reasons for why they left: I was not allowed to ask questions, and the science issue was never addressed. So, and I got the same results from those atheists there at Caltech attending this conference. Those are the two big reasons. Now, the 20% were people who told me stories about being abused by a pastor or a priest. And so, and that often gets a lot of publicity, but to me it wasn't the majority. And it's not the majority what you see in the Pew and the Barna studies either, just a small minority of people actually have had these experiences of being abused by a pastor, an elder, or a priest. But the big issues are no opportunity to ask questions, and no one's helping me with the science faith issues. So that's why I've been telling pastors as I speak around America here, every church I know where the sermon is followed up by an open mic Q&A, where people can ask anything and people get a legitimate response to the questions, those are churches that are growing by adult converts to Christianity. I've yet to meet a church that has that in practice that's not growing by adult conversions. And it's like, from my perspective, that's what church is for. It's a place where you can come and ask the hardest questions. And I actually talk to pastors and saying, this is highly biblical. Just read the Psalms of David. David was spewing out anger towards God because he wasn't getting answers to his questions. He wanted answers. And you know, he was patient and God gave him answers. He had to wait, but the whole point, and that's okay too. Ask a question, I tell pastors this, if you don't have a good answer, tell them you don't have a good answer. It's better to tell the person, I don't have a good answer to your question, than to give them a lame answer to their question. And basically volunteer, give me time to research this. We'll come back and we'll discuss it again. It's basically communicating, we are open to the hardest questions. In fact, I've argued with pastors, the whole principle of the Sabbath is taking regular time out of your week to focus on the most important issues of life. And what's more important than dealing with these questions that are coming from unbelievers about the meaning of life? And so we need to be open to that. And as far as the science question goes, it's even in the creeds. Article 2 of the Belgic Confession, God gave us two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. Both are revelations of God's truth without error. And so we need to be actually communicating that to people who come to church. And what these atheists were telling me, every Christian we've met until we met you was afraid of science. Every time we brought up science, they changed the subject. And so it basically is telling us that reasons to believe, we need to be more proactive in equipping Christians to be able to use the book of nature to bring people to the book of scripture. Because evidently, based on Pew and Barna, that's the main reason why people are leaving the church. So it should be a wake-up call to all of us.
Well, okay, I'm involved in a couple other types of ministry.
Let's wait for the microphone. Can you get him the microphone? Because he'd make him a good point here.
I'm associated with a couple other churches in the west side where we live. And so I kind of, I've learned, you know, how they operate. And these two factors that you mention, well, for one thing, the churches that I've come in contact with, they have no emphasis, basically, on learning about the important support of science of the Bible, and so I guess what I'm saying, and you bring up the point, I guess, that you think those two factors are really maybe the prime or great reasons why we're losing people.
Yeah, they rank one and two, yeah, the top two reasons for why people leave the church, adults leave the church.
Okay, so I guess my only point then is that, my own view, of course, is that the science should be taught, and but it's hard to get that message through, and what you bring up, your further point of answering questions would be a second major point that I think churches, but to me it's a critical issue. The fact that people are almost being driven away from the church for these lack of understanding.
Well, to me, what's ironic, this is what the church is supposed to be all about, is answering people's questions about faith issues. And the fact that we're shutting that down, that should be a wake-up call to all of us. But I think it's also a wake-up call to people like you and me. We're scientists. We shouldn't put it on the pastors to answer all the tough questions about how do you integrate the book of nature and the book of scripture. We need to volunteer to help them. And so what I've been sharing with pastors is, you know, there are engineers and scientists that are part of your congregation. When it comes time for the Q&A time, invite them to come up and help you field the questions. You don't have to do it by yourself. I mean, people love posing questions to a panel. In fact, that was routine at this conference I was at in North Carolina. You know, four of us would be up there as a panel fielding questions, and because there was four of us, we could handle questions across a wide spectrum. But so often, the senior pastor thinks, I got to handle all the questions by myself. And your average senior pastor, last time they took a science class was when they were having to do the requirement, and they took physics for poets when they were in university, which doesn't really equip them to answer these kinds of questions. We need to volunteer to help them. So I'm also talking to research scientists or Christians and saying, do not be a wallflower in your church. You need to get actively involved in the ministry. The elders and the pastors there need your help. And you need to engage them in such a way that doesn't frighten them. So make sure you don't talk to them in six-syllable words and scare them off. And you know, in fact, I tell research scientists, why don't you have these pastors over to your place for dinner so they can get to know you, realize that you're a regular guy or a regular gal, and that you're there to help them, and that you're not going to intimidate people. And because that's often the response I get from pastors. They assume that if you're a scientist, that you're going to be intimidating to people in the group, and you're going to intellectually lord it over them. And so you need to personally demonstrate that's not your style.
Well, in going to the pastors, of course, you have to, that's a hurdle you have to get over also, because often they will have their own insecurity about discussing with you this new issue, these science issues. And to bring that into a church is a hurdle itself.
It is, but you made a good point. Often when you're engaging pastors and trying to challenge them to have Q&A and engage these science faith issues, you expose some insecurities. They haven't been trained in this stuff. It's important that we who are scientists approach them in a way that's the least intimidating possible. And what I tell a lot of my research scientist friends, just the fact that you've got a PhD by itself is an intimidation factor. And so you need to be able to engage these people in a way where you don't use scientific language and you don't talk down to them. And it usually takes several weeks or months before these pastors are willing to trust you. So, and let them know you're willing to be patient. Often they're worried about how you're going to treat people when you answer a question. And so what I've done when I go into churches, I say, look, I'm happy to give the sermon messages, but could you give me 10 minutes of Q&A after each sermon? I'll cut my talk by 10 minutes in order to make time for open mic Q&A. Right away, they think, oh boy, you're a scientist. You're going to really intimidate people. And says, no, wait a minute. Here's a DVD of me answering questions. Watch the DVD. They watch the DVD and they say, okay, we're going to let you have a Q&A time. And by the way, 10 minutes is not enough. If I'm in a church where they got three morning services, I'll give three messages. And what I really like to do is give three different messages where there's a 10-minute Q&A after each sermon. Then we have a lunch meeting where we got an hour and a half of Q&A. If you do that, the unbelievers will flock. And the people who have left the church will come back. It's been my experience anyway. Okay, can we get to the book of Isaiah, or is there another hand? We got a hand over here. Steve over here has got a question.
As we work perhaps in different local churches for...
Can you hold the mic a little closer? Thank
sure.
You.
I really enjoy this question. As we may be involved in other churches, perhaps we live far out and involved in those churches. To turn a big ship sometimes is hard, but once it's turned, there's a lot of power there, so it's worth putting in the work rather than making one's stand by the oneself and just forgetting the ship. In the ship, is there something we should consider in the pilot also having a board and Sunday schools, and somehow develop relationships that way?
Yes. For example, I found that churches will not let me do a Q&A session until I first have a private meeting with the pastors. So we'll set up some kind of Zoom or Skype meeting where they can see me, I can see them, and we'll talk. And that will help. Also, turning the ship around, if I know it's really going to be difficult to turn around, we'll say, well, how about if we just start with a Q&A time with the junior high students in your church? They're not donors, so that takes that factor away. And so we have a Q&A time with the junior high people, and I always invite some of the pastors to just observe what goes on, so they get to actually see what happens with a Q&A time. And by the way, they get to see that even children, I mean, sometimes I say, you know, put me with the six-year-olds. And they get to see that these six-year-olds really have challenging spiritual questions. And so I kind of communicate to them, look, you know, these kids raised in Christian homes, they got questions. They have questions at a very early age. And doesn't it make sense to answer their questions when they're asking them, rather than telling them to wait till they're in college? Let's get to them early. So that's one strategy I've used to try to turn the ship around, saying, okay, I understand you're a little bit nervous about how people are putting money in the offering plate, might respond to a scientist answering questions. Let's take that off the table. Let's just work with the junior high or the high school kids or the six-year-olds. Let them see how that works. And basically, it's kind of what we were just sharing here. There needs to be a building of trust. They need to see that you're prepared to handle a Q&A session without being intimidating, without being sarcastic, without intellectually lording it over people. If they get to see that, say at a junior high level, then they might trust you to do it with the adults. So again, patience. Just like it takes time to turn a big ship around, it takes time to turn a big church around as well. Well, let them, and by the way, I also tell them, why don't you phone this pastor that had me come in and to do a Q&A time and just talk to him? So they get to see, hey, it does work in other churches. Maybe it can work in my church. I've yet to meet a pastor that wouldn't like to see more adults attending their church. They all want to see more adults attending their church. And, you know, a lot of them are afraid about getting more scientists and engineers in the church because they look at that people group as being intimidating. Sometimes I remind them that your typical engineer and scientist tends to earn a higher income than other people in the population. And if you get them putting money in the offering plate, that could really help grow your church. So, and the whole point is, it tells us in the Great Commission, all people groups, scientists are a people group, engineers are a people group, dentists are a people group, we need to reach out to all these different people groups. Anyway, enough said. I got a few minutes left to get us into Isaiah, so let's do that. What I've done this morning is to bring a whole bunch of handouts. So, by the way, let me get out of this, and we'll bring up our Isaiah stuff. Hopefully you can all see that. That's one of the handouts I have here for you. But a lot of you have been asking me, those of you who are especially new to the class, about the past handouts. And so I did bring a whole bunch with me here. Okay, we've been going through the book of Isaiah, and incidentally, here are the 12 questions we've been asking about the book of Isaiah and what it's got to say about science faith issues. And one of the sets of questions we looked at was, what does the book of Isaiah say about God's involvement in the beginning and creation of the universe? And we distributed this as a multi-page thing. I've reduced it down to a single page. It's 10-point type now, not 12-point type, but it's a single page. And so you don't have that. And to complement that is all the passages in Isaiah that talk about the end of the universe. So you got the beginning of the universe and the end of the universe. So we can distribute those as well. And then finally, we have, and I brought plenty of these. I didn't bring so many of those other ones because I know a lot of you have them already. But we got 60 copies here of this particular handout, what Isaiah and other passages say about the rebirth of Israel as a nation for the second time. And 2 weeks ago when I was here, we got started on this. And let me actually pull this down a little bit more so you can see the rest of it. If I can get my cursor over there. Here we go. Anyway, there's 5 subheads here in the paper, and you'll see it in your handout. And what I've done here is not just focus on Isaiah. Isaiah's got the most to say about the rebirth of Israel for a second time as a nation. But what I've done here is actually to include everything in the Bible on these five subheads under that theme. And this really isn't so much science and faith, but it does make the interesting point. Not only can we make a scientific case for the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible, we can make an historical case. And what you see in the New Testament is how Jesus and the apostles frequently cited the Old Testament, making the point the Old Testament in hundreds of places prophesied that the Messiah would come. God the Redeemer would come as a human being to planet Earth, and there are plenty of details in it. But what impressed me when I was first studying the Bible in my late teenage years is not only do we see in the Old Testament all these passages predicting the future coming of the God the Redeemer advocate, it also predicts that there will be a second rebirth of Israel as a nation. And the first thing I wanted to point out here, and incidentally, often I run into non-Christians who say, you know, all this talk from Christians about the Old Testament predicting that Jesus would come, that's 2,000 years ago. Show me something in the Bible that's happened in recent history. You know, the Bible was written thousands of years ago. I want to see the Bible bold enough to make statements about something that's happened in recent history. Here's this example. And what I find interesting, yes, you got hundreds of passages in the Bible that talk about the coming of Christ, the first coming and the second coming. You also got hundreds of passages in many different books of the Bible predicting that the nation of Israel would be born, it would die, and it would be reborn, and gives us specific details about that rebirth. And the first point we have up here is how frequently the Bible talks about there would be a worldwide dispersion of Jews all over the world. And one of the things I remember reading in history in my secular high school at age 17 was a statement by the historian. He says, the one miracle we see in history are the Jews. And what he meant by that is, here is a people that was scattered all over the world for 2,000 years, yet they retained their identity, they retained their language. He says that has never happened to a people group before. Any other people group that got scattered got assimilated into the general population of the peoples that they lived with. He says that did not happen to the Jews. Moreover, this happened to the Jews when they were being scattered and persecuted. He says, who ever heard of a people group being scattered and persecuted for 2,000 years, yet they retain their culture, their identity, their language? So this never happened before. He made that comment, wrote it, before Israel was formed as a nation in 1948. He says, just the fact that we have Jews all over the world that retain their identity as Jews, their language as Jews, and their desire to be a nation again as Jews, says that to me as an historian is an outright miracle. We've never seen it happen before in human history. Now, that historian never commented on the fact that the Bible predicted that the Jews would be scattered all over the world, they'd be scattered for a long time, and they'd be persecuted everywhere they were scattered. But it goes all the way back to the writings of Moses himself. And so I'd like us to, I put a star beside those two passages in Deuteronomy. You also see a brief reference in Leviticus. But Leviticus and those two passages in Deuteronomy, this is where Moses comes out. And I had all of you read this. So again, I'm going to put this back on you. What does Moses tell the Jews? I mean, here they are coming out of Egypt to form the nation of Israel in the land of Canaan. And before they enter the land of Canaan, Moses tells them what's going to happen to them in the future and why it's going to happen to them. I know some of you have read this stuff. Tell you what, I'll just read you one brief passage, and then I'm going to get your feedback on this. Okay, it says, you need to read basically all of chapter 28, but here's how it ends. just as it pleased the Lord to make you prosper and increase in number in your land, so it will please him to ruin and destroy you. You'll be uprooted from the land you're entering to possess. Then the Lord will scatter you among all nations, from one end of the earth to the other. There you'll worship other gods, gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. Among those nations you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing, and a despairing heart. You will live in constant suspense, filled with dread, both night and day, never sure of your life. In the morning you will say, if only it were evening, and the evening, if only it were morning, because of the terror that will fill your heart and the sights your eyes will see. The Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt on a journey I said you would never make again. There you'll offer yourself for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but no one will buy you. Any of you know the Roman history of that last sentence? Okay, 70 AD, Titus comes in and puts down the Jewish rebellion, destroys the temple, knocks it all down, gathers up all the Jews, takes the Jews to Egypt and sells them as slaves. But there were so many Jews being sold for slaves, basically the price went down to zero and they were giving away Jews for no price at all. Here we got Moses, 1,500 years before the event, predicting that's what's going to happen to the Jews. They'll be gathered up in such large numbers and sold for slaves to a point where they'll have no worth, and they'll be given away as slaves. And they were sent all throughout the Roman Empire, the Parthian Empire. In 70 AD, Jews were scattered throughout the entirety of the Roman and Parthian Empire. And the Romans were basically selling Jews outside the Roman Empire as well, and outside the Parthian Empire. And that began the worldwide dispersion of Jews. Okay, this is one text. If you read those other passages, sorry about the mountain scenery there, read those other passages up there, it gives you specific details about what that dispersion of the Jews will look like. But again, I would encourage you, just share this with people who are not yet believers. It astounds them, the detail to which the Bible thousands of years ago predicted all the details of the worldwide dispersion of the Jews. And could one of you comment? Some of these passages explain exactly why God did this to the Jews. Anybody remember that passage? Well, the hardness of their hearts, but with God's, again, I hope you need to look at these passages. Two of the passages make the point. I called you out of the land of Samaria, put you in the land of Canaan for a purpose. I put you at the junction of three continents, and you are to be a light to the nations. You're to be my emissaries spreading my message. And it says, when I disperse you throughout the nations of the world, as people come into contact with you and hear what you've got to say, they're going to be rejecting me instead of accepting me. It says, you have blasphemed my name throughout all the world. All these nations I scattered you. You want to know why your worldwide scattering has lasted so long? Everywhere I sent you, you blasphemed my name. Now, put that into context. Based on what you know in the New Testament, what was happening during the diaspora? That's a technical name for the dispersion of the Jews to all the nations of the world. Here we have him saying, you blaspheme my name everywhere I sent you. This is why it's lasted so long. What is he referring to there? What's the blasphemy? Yes. Go ahead. We need a microphone. Let's get a
What was going on was they were profaning God's name, primarily Jesus.
Well, how were they profaning God's name?
Well, they were...
Okay, let me make this a little easier for you. This profanity is still going on today amongst the Jews that are still partly scattered around the world. What is the profanity? I mean, if you run into a Jew, they would insist, I'm not profaning the name of God. I hold God in high respect. But we have these passages saying, you have misrepresented me, you have blasphemed me, and you're leading people astray instead of leading people towards me.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were supposed to be the priest of the world.
They were supposed to be the priests of the world. Incidentally,
Christ.
Jews throughout the entire diaspora considered themselves the priests of the world.
Right.
This is why the language is so harsh. He says, you Jews think you are the priests of the world spreading my message, but instead you blaspheme my message. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got a hand back there. Again, what does he mean when he says? Because that's the response of the Jews. We haven't done this. You know, we've done exactly what you told us to do. We've been priests of the world. We've been trying to convert everybody to Judaism.
All I've heard, particularly over the last week or two on TV, is basically they never gave God glory for things. They took credit for themselves. I don't know.
Well, that's actually a prophecy you're going to see. And we look at the passage, talk about the rebirth of Israel for a second time as a nation, is that God performs miracles on their behalf to establish their nation for a second time. And we got passages in Ezekiel say they will not give God the credit. They said we did it by their own hand. But I'd like to get explicitly, what did this passage mean about you blaspheming my name to all the nations I sent you? Go ahead.
Was it denying Jesus?
Okay. Good point. I mean, they do believe the Messiah is going to come, just that he hasn't come yet. But yeah, they did not convert to Christianity, but more than that. Okay, again, what's the heart of Jewish theology? Yes.
They set a barrier between God and the people, that you had to be Jewish, you had to do this, you had to do all these different requirements that God never made.
Well, that's part of it.
I'm not going to answer that question. I'm just going to propose that we're over time.
We're over time. Yes. Okay. I see that. Okay.
Sorry about
Here's
that.
The whole
I'm the guardian of the clock.
The basic difference between Jewish theology and Christian theology, Jewish theology is basically saying, if you do good works, you'll make it. Christian theology says no matter what you do in the way of good works, that will not be sufficient. You need the Redeemer to do for you what you can't do for yourself. That's how the Jews blasphemed the name of the Lord to all the nations they went. They said, you don't need God, just do the best you can through good works, that will do it. That's the same religion that all the non-Christians believe in. God's going to weigh you out in the balance. If your good works outweigh your bad works, you're going to make it. Which is why it's so important, look at Ezekiel 32. And now I'm out of time, but do check Ezekiel 32. It really tells you the sermon that God had Ezekiel give to the Jews on the worthlessness of trying to make it through your own human good works and what will happen to you in that response. Okay, sorry about going over time. Next time I'm with you, we'll pick this up where we left off. And I need to look at my calendar to see. I've been told I'm not going to be missing a lot of Sundays in November. However, I think I'm going to be here every Sunday in December and January. Father in heaven, Lord, we want to thank you again for this amazing prophet, this Isaiah. Thank you that you had him live as long as he did and write all this prophecy under four different kings of Judah. And Lord, we thank you for the fact that he was able to withstand and persevere in the spite of great persecution. And Lord, we thank you too for what we see right before our eyes, what has happened to Jews all over the world and how you're bringing them back into the nation of Israel. And everything you predicted about the Jews and the rebirth of Israel for a second time is coming true right before our eyes. And the next few years, we'll see even more. Lord, show us how we can use this as a way to alert people to the fact that the Bible is no ordinary book. It's a Bible inspired by the one who actually created the entire universe, created all of us as the master of all the nations, is in control of the future of every nation and every human being. In Jesus' name, amen.